Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have James Edwards on the show. James is the creator and host of The Political Cesspool, one of my favorite names for a talk show or podcast or radio program. What do you want to call it? A syndicated AM talk radio program. Of course, it's on actually radio, like the old days, right? You listen to it and there's a that distortion that you hear usually when you listen to AM radio, it's authentic. I always thought it sounded authentic. You know, the FM sound was always kind of pretentious. But anyway, political cesspool, about 20 years now?
It'll be 20 years next fall. So we are in the midst of our 19th year. And this is a real highlight, Tim. I know we've been trying to put this together for a while, and it's great to be on with you tonight. I really appreciate the invitation.
Well, certainly. Thank you for coming back on the show. I mean, for coming on the show. You, of course, are a writer. You have written the book Racism, Smashism. Is that what? Racism, Smashism, right?
That came out in 2010. Yes, I did. That was my one and only book from start to finish. I actually did contribute the opening chapter to a new compilation that came out in April. It's a book called The Honorable Cause of Free South, and it's I and 11 other co-authors, each writing 12 essays. But yeah, Racism, Smashism came out in 2010. I wrote that, man, a lot's changed since then, simultaneously for the better and for the worst. But I wrote that book in 2010 as sort of a response to the Tea Party. You know, that was before this, whatever's going on now in the Republican base, that was sort of like the resistance back in the around 2010. And I just said, guys, you know, we got to get past this thing about being scared of the R word. Mm-hmm. And I sort of wrote a book with some humor and some examples of just how frivolous and baseless those charges are. But it really for a long, long time tripped up conservatives. They would do anything, including absolute surrender, to try to avoid being called a racist or something like that. So we try to help them along.
Yeah. And yeah, this book, The Honorable Cause, A Free South, published, I guess it was on Confederate Day.
Came out on April 1st. So that's okay. Actually, Confederate History Month. That's actually something that all the Southern states used to celebrate. And it's still celebrated by official proclamation in some Southern states. But April was, of course, the month in which the Confederacy was founded and the month in which the war ended. So from 1860 to 1865. And so that's why it came out in April. We came out on the first of the month. We were in Traveler's Rest, South Carolina, when we launched that book. I had a nice little book signing there.
And you went on like a tour, didn't you?
We've been all over the place this summer. I'm going to actually leave tomorrow to go to Dallas, which will be the last stop. We've been traveling pretty consistently since the spring.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, safe travels. Well, tonight, let's talk. You recently gave an address at the American Renaissance, their annual conference, correct?
That is right. That was, let's see, that was in mid-August. So about a month ago. It was a month ago this weekend, actually.
And it was, Reasons for Optimism. You offered a kind of a long-term perspective on the American right and sort of the ethnogenesis that may occur among ethnic whites in America. For the longest time, they've been denied a real identity. In fact, many say they've sort of deracinated to create white identity, to put them in this perilous sort of weak situation where they cannot really identify any particular interest or identity other than being blamed and being taxed, and being harassed and hectored. Also, being discriminated against in applications for employment and Ivy League colleges. then there is an identity. But you gave this talk.
Race is a social construct unless you're looking for whites to blame for the underachievement of other people groups. And then, of course, race is very real.
Okay, so well, you describe yourself as a Southern nationalist.
Yeah, it's our show, and I guess the show takes on my identity. You mentioned the name of it. It's funny. I probably would have if I could go back and rename it. I might rename it to something a little more glorious. But at the time, I wanted it to be something that was a little different and didn't put the spotlight on me. You know, everybody just has, you know, the so-and-so show. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong, you know, the host name, and that's the show. But I thought it was catchy. I thought it would be something that got people's attention, and boy, did it ever. I don't know how much the name played into that or if it was the content, but after the first you know, couple of years, we were pretty much fixtures and still to this day in the establishment news, and have made a lot of news over the years. So you definitely, I'm a guy who hangs my hat on loyalty. So I'm going to stick with the one who took me to the dance. And so we'll keep it the political cesspool for as long as we're there.
Yeah, I mean, the Jimmy Edwards Show kind of rolls off the tongue. That'd be good, an eponymous name for a show.
You know what's funny, Tim? My dad's name is Jimmy. And yeah. I've always gone by James, James, and I know a lot of people go by Jim or Jimmy, but my dad's name actually on his birth certificate is Jimmy.
Oh, really?
J-I-M-M-Y. So he's Jimmy. I'm James. My grandfather is James. I've got an uncle named James. There's a lot of Jameses, but he is the only Jimmy.
And your co-host is Keith Alexander, right?
That's right. Keith Alexander the Great, as we call him.
Yeah, I had him on the show.
I know. He told me he really had a great time.
Yeah. He's a lawyer, right?
He is.
Yeah, yeah. So he, you know, like you Southerners, the way you all talk, you're slow, you're, we just think you're dumb. But you talk to this guy, and you're like, whoa. I mean, he's
something. He's really something. Got that encyclopedic knowledge of historical facts and a lot of anecdotal things and a lot of old Southern sayings and colloquialisms. And we have a good time, you know. So I'm in my early 40s and he in his mid 70s. So it's an odd pairing, but I tell you what, that we balance each other out.
Well, he's witness to a lot of history, and you got to, you know, while these old timers are still around, I'm rapidly becoming one myself, I guess. But you got to plumb their mind, you know, get their perspective on these things.
Well, I'm older than I used to be. I can tell you that. I certainly feel older. I've been doing this for 20 years. And so I can tell a little bit of difference between 40 and 20. I guess the people who are 60, 70, 80 listening to this are going to laugh at that. But yeah, I'm the world's oldest 40-year-old. All of my friends are at least a decade or more older than me. So.
Well, they say, well, getting older is a symptom of not dying yet.
So. Yeah, that's right.
So, well, anyway, so yeah, let's talk about this. You gave this talk at the American Renaissance. Now, the American Renaissance doesn't market itself as a particularly a Southern, but there's some cross-pollination.
Oh, wait, you asked me about that. I'm sorry, Tim. Yeah. You asked me about, do I identify as a Southern nationalist? Yeah. Yes, I do. That's one of the things. The show is really sort of like it stands on a tripod. It's our show intersects between Southern nationalism, white advocacy, pro-white activism, and traditional Christianity. So if you put all of those three elements in a blender, what would be served out is who I am and what the program is about. And even AMRIN is more of a white advocacy organization, which is of course one of the three pillars that I just mentioned. But Jared Taylor, who's the head of AMRIN, is a great friend of mine, a longtime friend. We just actually went down to Alabama the week after AMRIN. Jared and I both spoke at a conference in Alabama, and we went and toured Selma. And Jared doesn't wear it on his sleeve as much as I do, but anybody who knows Jared knows he's a very, very, very proud Southerner, and that's very near to his heart as well. Although they focus more on crime and race and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, yeah, he did a sort of a took a lot of pictures down in Selma.
No, yeah, you saw that. You sure did, boy. I tell you what, if you want to get a dose of racial reality, just go down to Selma and you'll see the real deal.
Well, you keep your eyes on the prize. There's the prize.
Ooh, that was I'll never forget that day. I've been down to Selma before. I actually gave a speech down there last summer. And then we were in Montgomery for the most recent talk, and that's only about an hour from Selma, so we couldn't be that close and not go see it again. And we took a little more comprehensive tour of Selma this time. I was just I did a little bit of the old in and out last year, but yeah, that was it's eye opening, and the truth is out there. But you asked about my AMRIN talk, reasons for optimism, and there are, Tim, a lot of reasons for optimism. And, you know, you monitor these things. I monitor these things. And so we sort of live in it. But I don't know if people are fully aware, unless they're listening to alternative media outlets, just how much things have changed. And in a lot of ways for the better, and in a lot of ways for the worse. And these two forces are on a collision course for one another. But you would certainly not know just how much the Republican base, as I put it in the AMRIN talk, has radicalized in the best sense of the word. We're talking about predominantly white Republicans who voted for Donald Trump. They have rapidly arrived at our destination over the course of the last 3 years. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I went through all of it in my 45-minute talk. Now, I would be very happy just to sit here and give the speech all over again for your audience. You're a talk radio guy. I'm a talk radio guy. We don't need prompting. So you just tell me what you want me to hit, and I'll hit it, and I'll try not to talk too long.
you cite a sort of a consciousness that's developing. Now, of course, the past 60 years, the racial narrative of the past 60 years, the civil rights movement has sort of frowned upon the idea of ethnic white Americans having any legitimate grievances, because we have this idea of white privilege. And just kind of the narrative is evil whites oppressing innocent oppressed blacks. And you and I both know it's much more complicated than that. And any, I think, informed, intelligent, fair-minded person would acknowledge that as well. But nevertheless, the media, academia, Hollywood, and all that gives us this sort of this binary, if I may use that that term, view of things. It's sort of like the, you know, the good, the bad. We have the movies like, you know, like Mississippi Burning, to Kill a Mockingbird. This is sort of like Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Well,
film, right?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, Emmett Till. There's breaking news on the Emmett Till case every week, even though there hasn't been a new development since the mid-50s. Anytime a white has behaved badly, there's movies, there's books, there's a constant drumbeat about the whatever it was. But of course, it's very, very, very rare. As the aforementioned Keith Alexander put it, it's more like Halley's Comet. It's just exceedingly rare. What is quite, you know, infinitely more likely to happen is, of course, black on white murder or violence or rape or whatever. But yeah, so there's certainly the media chooses what it wants to exaggerate and what it wants to, you know, entirely flush down the memory hole.
Yes. I mean, a lot of the things, you know, kind of like the narrative of sort of this, the benighted retrograde South and Jim Crow and segregation and sort of the enlightened forces of integration, forced integration and busing, and this is
yeah,
progress,
we got to own all of that, though, because as a matter of fact, and I'm a Southerner, and I'm born and raised down here. My ancestors fought for the Confederacy. That's something I'm very proud of. And I think it's an interesting thing. We get along with blacks for the most part. You can't live in an area like Memphis. You see blacks every day, and I'm as kind and polite to them as I would be to anyone else. But at the same time, we got to own that back in the 50s and 60s. And we got to own it by saying they were right. And if you don't believe that they were right in wanting to keep these disparate elements of society separate, and then they said separate but equal, and that was, of course, pilloried and all of that. But go to Selma and you'll understand. I think, you know, watch Jared Taylor's video on Selma. That is why integration is not a good idea for our people. And that is why people sensibly wanted to keep it at an arm's length from their communities at the time. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, that you're not mistreating people necessarily to say that racial conflict, you know, race relations, let me put it this way, can be summed up in one word. And that word is conflict. If you have people with different heroes, different faith, different cultures, different folkways, different languages in some cases, you just can't have people with competing interests occupying the same living space. It just doesn't work. And we don't wish anybody ill will, but I think there was a very solid reason for segregation.
Well, the fact that it had to be done away with forcefully suggests that it was against what the people wanted on both sides.
You know, no, sure. Forced, well, you know,
forced busing, forced integration, the 101st Airborne coming in.
The whole idea, though, I mean, it was the whole civil rights thing was just an anti-white program. But the idea that blacks were wildly mistreated in the South was just not true. Matter of fact, I had the opportunity over the last 20 years, we've interviewed a lot of very interesting people. And one of the people I interviewed was Drew Lackey, who was the officer who arrested Rosa Parks. He was the one pictured in the iconic photo fingerprinting Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. Now, he was just a beat officer at the time. But he went on to become the chief of police in Montgomery, Alabama. And he wrote a book, Another View of the Civil Rights Movement. And he puts in the book exactly what the whole thing was all about. And I actually, you know, Selma is a real holy place in terms of the civil rights mythology, Bloody Sunday and the bridge and all of that. And I saw an interview that was done by an American university. It might have been St. Louis University. And I was surprised that they still had it up. But the sheriff, his name was Jim Clark, the sheriff of Selma at the time of so-called Bloody Sunday. And they asked him, when he looks back on it, what's his biggest takeaway? And he said how easily the American public was duped. And this was something that the officer who arrested Rosa Parks said as well. He said at that bridge on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, where they had so-called Bloody Sunday. Now, the only thing you remember about that, the narrative was that you had all of these bigoted, racist, white Alabama state troopers that just because they hate black people, they started beating them in the head to deny them voting rights, you know, for no good reason. Well, he said the truth of the matter was there were more officers injured that day than so-called peaceful protesters. And he said that the reason the officers started swinging the batons was because before that happened, you know, every time you would get the dogs, you would get the fire hoses, you would get the batons. That's the moment the newsreel started rolling. That's the moment the cameras started rolling. That's what you would see on the news. What you didn't see and what you couldn't possibly know unless you were either there or you talked to people who were there like we have done. The sheriff there in Selma said on that day on the bridge, the black marchers had straight razors, ice picks, knives, bricks, and bottles that they were swinging at or throwing at the officers. And that's what prompted some of them to get beaten. But, you know, again, that's the real history and that's what was really going on. But he said before all of that, he said that outside agitators came in, and you hear this a lot from people who were alive back then and old enough to remember, that the black and white race relations in Selma, there were no problem. Blacks and whites had lived together in the South forever up until the 1960s, and it was never really a problem. At times that, you know, there was slavery, there was segregation, there was all of this, but they all got along. I mean, it wasn't a bunch of white supremacists just beating and terrorizing these folks. I know that's what the movies say, but that just wasn't the fact. They got along. I can attest to that even in the 80s. But he said that the people came in and they that they got all of that. It was all manufactured. It was outside influences coming down into some. Anyway, I'm chasing a rabbit now on that. That's probably not what we wanted to talk about. But
well, it's interesting. This, of course, that element or aspect to that, those events weren't reported in the national press or by the New York Times. So it didn't occur to the American people. And also it played to the vanities of the Americans in the North. You saw them, you know, the puritanical streak and see themselves as, you know, morally superior and also sort of on a crusade. You know,
but nothing changed. Tim, nothing changed.
Yeah.
We saw this again during the year of George Floyd. The Black Lives Matter combatants, these terrorists, these anarchists, they were the ones committing arson. They were the ones. We saw them throwing bricks and projectiles at the cops. They were doing the exact same thing then that they did in the so-called civil rights movement. And once again, being called peaceful protesters. Now, a bunch of old people milling around in the Capitol is a violent insurrection, and people burning down police stations is a peaceful protest. And it's just so Orwellian. And then, you know, like we're seeing now, Donald Trump facing 1,000 years in prison, and they're trying to remove him from ballots. They're trying to disqualify him from running. They're arresting not just him, but his lawyers. And that's how we protect democracy, from removing the man that people want to vote for with these, pardon the term, trumped up charges. I mean, everything is absolutely inverted. Everything you think you know, it's exactly the opposite.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talk about segregation, and that's just terrible even to speak about. Although people segregate all the time. They have in-group preferences, and particularly in their personal lives and in their private lives.
Why wouldn't you want to associate with people who have more commonality with you than others? Why wouldn't you want to be amongst people who have things in common?
Then you can coalesce, press your interests, and organize politically. They don't want that. They want to babble. You know.
And like I said, I mean.
Yeah. Well, the reason I brought that up is I just saw someone sent me a headline today from the New York Times, an article, we need black majority states.
Well,
they gerrymander black congressional districts with the Voting Rights Act. They misinterpret it. So they assume blacks have to vote for blacks, but whites can't have that same, you know, I guess, ethnic representation. But the point is, the New York Times now calling explicitly, I mean, I guess implied in that is segregation, right? Segregate.
Well, again, yeah, it's perfectly fine for them to do it. Of course, they're going to have racial solidarity. Of course, they're going to support black-owned businesses and champion one another's causes and advance their identity and their ethnic and racial interests. And not only is that allowed, it's celebrated, it's encouraged. But you say you're white and you want to do the same thing for natural reasons, then you're an evil white supremacist, Nazi, so on and so forth. And, you know, again, and I think increasingly people are starting to see through this. People had been far too comfortable for far too long, and they were looking after number one, and they maybe didn't like the direction the country was headed in, but, you know, it was still at a distance to them. It's getting a lot more close to them now, and it's getting a lot harder to evade. And again, there are a lot of reasons now where the Republican base, you can talk to a part and partial standard Republican voter now about these issues, and they're not going to flinch. It's just been an incredible and very rapid transformation that the average Republican has experienced over the last, especially the last 3 years since the Floyd.
Yeah, just Summer of Floyd, Summer of Love, and that. So all the outrageous propaganda and the rioting, the mostly peaceful rioting, and sort of this, I guess it was a nationwide struggle session against white Americans. You know, of course, of all people, I mean, at least in the past, when they had these civil rights icon, they would construct a myth behind them that suggested these were people of high character. You know, it was like George Floyd. It's just humiliation because the guy's obviously.
Well, you know, they weren't any better. Martin Luther King himself was no better. Really.
Yeah, but at least they lied about it.
Well, and then you didn't have social media, and you had three news channels. You just really didn't have, the internet has just really opened up the floodgate for truth and diversity. But, you know, it's funny. The gatekeepers, the system apparatus says that they love diversity. Diversity is our greatest strength. Well, they sure don't love the diversity of opinion. No. And if it were not for the internet, we'd still be stuck in those very dark days where they had complete monopoly over what the opinion is. But the truth is certainly growing now.
We've seen that recently with, you know, revelations the past few years regarding, you know, social media, Twitter, and Google and Facebook and the FBI liaising with each other to suppress a free speech and opinion and information to secure elections and to control the narrative, because the very thing you cited, the internet, for, you know, for the better part of, what was it, 10 years, maybe 12 years. All that broke down. All the gatekeepers lost their power, and you had that. And then about 5-6 years ago, they started shutting it down. Of course, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, was key to that. And we know that now, that they actually got the other ones that got Twitter to suspend Donald Trump, a sitting president, has a Twitter account.
This thing with the ADL is one of the most tremendous breakthroughs in the culture war, maybe the most significant breakthrough. That's really a final frontier, tackling that kind of power and influence. Racial realities, you know, they were taboo as recently as 5 to 10 years ago. You really couldn't talk about it. Now, pretty much everybody gets it, and they get it because, yes, I mean, truth is proliferating on the internet, but also, I mean, it's just gotten to the point now of absurdity to where people are asking themselves the rhetorical question, who am I going to believe, the media or my lying eyes? You've got these Proud Boys doing 20 years in prison, and then you've got the people, these terrorists and Antifa and Black Lives Matter, who not only weren't bothered when they were engaging in their acts of anarchy in 2020. If they did happen to be inconvenienced by being arrested, now they're being paid out. They're being paid out for the trouble that they endured, having to face the injustice of being arrested for any of that stuff. So, and people are seeing this now. They're like, you know, wait a minute, you know, I think we're going to take a different route here. And it's gotten, it's accelerated so much. These are some of the things that I was saying in my Amran talk. I mean, and I was citing all of the system polls, whether it be Rasmussen or YouGov. I mean, it was all, you know, CNN, all of their polls. And you've got now 73% of Trump voters think that the Democrats are trying to replace white people with immigrants and people of color who share their political views. That's what they call the great replacement. They say it's a theory, but just look at the, or a conspiracy theory or a racist theory. Look at the numbers. It's absolutely true. But 73, this is the key. 73% of Trump voters, that's 73% of 70 million people. That's a lot of people who are starting to have common ground. You're seeing it, even establishment politicians now saying things, using some of our language, because that's what they have to say in order to keep up with where the base is. And 87% of Trump voters, again, these are establishment, mainstream, however you want to call it, system polls, 87% of Trump voters are worried about anti-white discrimination, 80% reject white privilege, 64% believe that their race and ethnicity is important to their identity. So this is all very good, but this is the thing I asked rhetorically, Tim, in that Amrin speech, is why now? Our ideas, the things that we were advocating for 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, however long ago you want to go back, however far you want to go back, our ideas are no more right today, no more correct today than they were at any point in the past. But why now are people beginning to find themselves in agreement with us and speaking out on these issues? And I said, it's the answer to that is what gives rise to any movement. It's the marriage of timing and circumstance. And in the past 2 to 3 years, you've had conditions present themselves as favorable to where this sort of a message can reach the people and really begin to spread. And it's in those last 2 to 3 years where you've had so much happen so fast that has forced basic conservatives to get on board. And what's happened in the last 2 to 3 years since the Biden inauguration and going back to George Floyd immediately before that, you've had, 200 monuments to American heroes that have been taken down and defaced, all the purging and censorship from the internet by big tech up to and including, as you mentioned, Donald Trump, the 6 months of nonstop violence by Antifa and Black Lives Matter, as we've discussed. You had the FBI and the DOJ turning a blind eye to that violence, completely excusing it. And then you've had these same so-called law enforcement agencies become weaponized against Trump and his supporters. This is what anarcho-tyranny is. I wrote an article about this for the American Free Press, which is actually going to be up on our website on Thursday. But and I would encourage people to check it out. This is anarcho-tyranny. They are going after people like Mr. Perry, Daniel Perry, I believe his name, in New York, and completely excusing, actual terrorists, and never-ending bombardment from the media. The definition of racism having been changed now. All white people are racist. All white people are to be held complicit in systemic racism and white supremacy. And too many people to count have been doxxed and fired and silenced over just mild differences of opinion. And you have the simultaneous push to indoctrinate kids with critical race theory and transgender propaganda from kindergarten onward. And the fact that Donald Trump told his followers that the elections are outright rigged and the majority have believed him. So you have all of that. That's a lot of radical stuff in 2 to 3 years. And it's really had an effect on white racial attitudes. 9 out of 10 Trump voters in another poll now agree that white people are under attack in America. And I don't think that toothpaste is going back in the tube. I mean, you have definitely turned a corner. You've definitely turned a corner in the last 3 years, not just since Trump and the first Trump administration, but really since 2020, you have turned a corner. And I don't think people are going to go back to the standard lesser of two evils, center right versus center left, Republican Democrat elections. I don't know if we're going to go back to elections at all. What's coming in America next year is going to be one for the books. Absolutely unprecedented.
Yeah, there's a, like I said, it's either the quickening or the circling of the bull, but things speed up. And, there are times, was it Lenin who said there are times, there are years when nothing happens and there.
Yeah, that's a great quote.
There's a week when everything happens.
That's it's funny you say that. I was stabbing it blindly for that quote in a recent show, and I totally butchered it. You got a lot closer to it than I did, but he's right.
And again, it's almost like they've accelerated themselves, which then you have a great noticing where people can no longer buy in or comfortably cope, say, well, the system's working, pay your taxes and you vote hard enough, it's going to represent your, at least sometimes, and that simply isn't happening. You had this, the great American majority is simply being disenfranchised effectively with voter fraud. And that's another thing with voting, the mass voting, race to the bottom, which democracy becomes, especially with mass voting. This started with the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and also with the Immigration Reform Act of 1965, Hart-Celler. We have this sort of opening of the floodgates. It was gradual at first because you had the white supermajority, which sort of maintained the integrity of the country, the identity, at least, its institutions, its culture. We did have something that bound us together, more or less. the wounds of the Civil War had been healed, been forged, and you had various wars.
Now look.
But after 65, we see that, and now we know there was an agenda behind that. In fact, when they signed the 65 Immigration Act, they promised it wouldn't change the country's demographics. But now, if you notice demographics, they call you a racist. But wait a second.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, this whole thing, I mean, Pat Buchanan writes this in The Death in the West, if you can separate people from their history, that's really one of the first prerequisites in destroying a people. And this whole thing now, all men are created equal, and America was always a proposition nation. I mean, all of that is completely false. Number one, you got to look at the context of Thomas Jefferson's all men are created equal. He wasn't talking about all races and all people group are equal. I mean, obviously no two people are equal, much less entire people groups are arriving at the same destination, the exact same talents and abilities. You'd have to be an abject fool to believe that. But he wasn't even the context of all men are created equal was this brother's quarrel that the colonists had with King George. It was the colonists were equal to King George under the law. It wasn't that all of humanity is equal and can build the same types of civilizations. So that was one thing. And this whole thing that we were a proposition nation, if you can get here, you're an American. Hell no. I mean, have you ever even read, has anybody ever read the original immigration laws of this country? Not even all white people were free. You had to be a free white man of good moral character. That would make about at least half the whites in this country not citizens. And you had to be a landowner. I mean, so no, this whole idea that anybody who gets to America is an American, I mean, that was never, ever, ever the vision of the founding fathers.
Well, anyone that's flown into the country or bussed in or shipped in by NGOs is an American.
Yeah, but people believe that now because they don't know their history.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have that poem, at the foot of the Statue of Liberty.
Oh my God. Well, they actually think that that's the law of America, that give us your wretched refuse. I mean, they actually think that's the immigration law of the country. It was just a poem that it has nothing to do with America.
You don't want a Jewish lady determining immigration.
Emma Lazarus.
Emma Lazarus, right? I mean, obviously. That's the thing. I mean, you've had, basically you had the flooding of the country after.
Well,
really, it picked up in the 90s, and that was intentional, but it was gradual. You had Reagan and his amnesty thing. He did nothing to solve the immigration problem, but everyone wanted cheap labor, and the Democrats want votes. They wanted, and certain states, certainly California as an example, where you can completely render the state completely, well, anarchic, so the elite can loot it, which we see in California. That's the vision they have for the rest of the country, and it's spreading. That's why the Biden administration and its Department of Homeland Security under Alejandro Mayorkas is intentionally flooding the country. He has no intention of protecting the country's borders, or quite the opposite. Because
you can certainly understand why the left-wing liberal elites want to flood the country. It's basically any third world immigration you have is a straight up Democratic Party voting drive. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're anti-white. And because they are elite, they know that they will be somewhat insulated from the country that they are making. You can't, I've said this on CNN when I was a guest on CNN before, you can't have a first world nation with a third world population. It's just that simple. It is just that simple. You can only have first world nations with the first world people. And Western civilization is certainly the standard bearer with regards to civilization, but that they think that because they have so much wealth that they'll be able to keep themselves away from it, at least for a while. But no, I mean, that was never, America was never intended to be a flop house for the third world. And this, I lost my train of thought, but I was about
well,
to
I mean, make... you say even America as a proposition nation, it's ideas that define America. The very propositions that supposedly define America, like the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, due process, these things that Americans believe in, it turns out by and large, it's only the ethnic white majority that really support those ideas. Because as you flood the country with non-whites, support for those institutions like the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment declines. In fact, they openly talk about that, how the Browning of America will lead to a cultural and political change of the country.
Of course.
Away from
of
its
course.
Founding principles. So at the end of the day, the proposition nation, it has ethnic you know, a ethnic foundation to it.
Well, you're all, you know, again, if you have competing people groups, you're always going to have conflict. You've got to have the only cohesive societies or homogenous societies. And this situation.
Well, the immigration issue isn't like it's organic or natural. It's weaponized. It's planned. You can chart out the organizations, the people behind it, and how it's being funded, NGOs, foundation money, tax money. I think the Biden administration is now forking over $2,200 a month for so-called migrants. Where do they get that money? Because they run the debt up for $32 trillion. So they're literally drowning the country in debt to subsidize mass illegal immigration.
I don't see how, you know, what is that money going to do for them? I mean, the cost of living and inflation is so prohibitive now, it's just killer out there. But you mentioned the Bill of Rights. Bill of Rights is all well and good, but it was meant for a certain people. It was meant for a single people group, and that is white people. Now, the pluribus unum, they're still talking about white nations. I mean, you can certainly take a Dane or a Swede or an Englishman or a Frenchman or a German or a Russian. Okay, those are different nations. Those are different nationalities. But you can put all of those people together and still have a cohesive society because they're all cousins. But you can't have people from third world, non-whites, and have that same sort of cohesion. And the idea, again, that we were a proposition nation, we were a blood and soil nation, clearly so, just like every other legitimate nation. No nation is an idea. A nation, by its very definition, is a people. A nation is a people. A country can be a system of government or a geographical plot of land, but a country is not a nation. A nation, literally, the etymology of the word nation, is a people group. Not a lot of different people groups, but a single people group. And then you mentioned after the war between the states, there was still enough commonality between those people up until the 1960s. America was still 90% white. So you could get past those that terrible war and the horrors of Reconstruction to an extent. But now we are more divided now than we ever were, more divided than we were during Jim Crow, more divided than we were in the war between the states, more divided than we were when slavery still existed, more divided than ever. I don't know if there's ever been a nation as divided as this one. And the only thing holding it together is a very tepid economy and our consumerism. But when that goes, it's going to be something.
Yeah, it's what do Americans have other than the purchasing power, the dwindling purchasing power of the dollars that they earn, that they get. And that's something where perhaps a region like the South has something to offer, because there still is a Southern identity of Southern people. And even from the standpoint of white identity, is you can see where white consciousness in the South pays political dividends, because they vote 75-80% for the Republican Party. Now, the Republican Party is a very flawed institution to represent, you know, their interests, but that's what they have. But it shows how identity and consciousness can have real political, you know, influence. If it's exercised. And what if all, you know, ethnic white Americans, we see that, like, if they did polls, what if only white males voted? You see, the whole country would be red.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
well, and you mentioned the South. One of the first and most important prerequisites for being an independent nation is having a culture that is separate from all of your surrounding areas. And still to this day, even though it's certainly not as robust as it once was, but in the rural South, you can still feel a very different culture than that in the rest of the United States. And a lot of reason for that is because the South suffered so badly in the war and in the Reconstruction, and even for decades after that. I mean, they were completely broken, completely destitute. And I'll tell you, you saw this with the people who suffered under communism and Bolshevism. People who suffer together become bound together. And that is why you still have white Southerners as a distinct people group hold on a little bit more to their identity than others. People who suffer, suffering is important. Suffering is important for people, and it's necessary. And well, I think that's one of the problems we've got, Tim, is that we have become too comfortable. We're going to have to suffer a little more in order to get hard again and do what's needed.
Yeah, so some element of martyrdom is necessary, both for, you know, for your own spiritual well-being and also for political well-being.
No, look at how you know, the comforts of being in America. What has that done for our people? It's made us mentally, physically, and spiritually out of shape. And all of this has happened because we've gotten too comfortable. Yeah, you know, flood us, but I've got beer in the fridge and the game's going to be on, of course, this weekend. So, you know, life's not too bad. I still got a boat, you know, we can still go on vacations. We can still do these things. But I think it's certainly coming now pretty quickly. The bill's going to be due for all of that laziness and kicking the can down the road. I mean, look, Tim, look at what's going on right now. Look at what's happening just this summer. Just this summer, my friend Brad Griffin over at OccidentalDescent.com has put together this list of things that have happened just since the beginning of the summer. Donald Trump running for president while facing 1,000 years in prison and 91 felony charges and counting. That's number one. And his lawyers have been indicted with him. I mean, he was arrested for the fourth time just, you know, back in Atlanta, fourth time this year, just a few weeks ago.
Didn't Fannie Willis also want to indict senators for supporting
Donald? Well, yeah, yes. I mean, listen to this. This is how they're just seeing, they've tested the limits of what they can get away with. And when you have these criminally corrupt, you see, Trump's not getting indicted in Iowa. He's getting indicted where you have black DAs and black sheriffs and things like that. Alvin Bragg up in New York, Letitia James in New York, obviously in Washington, D.C., which is like 92% black. You've got a black woman from Jamaica who's going to be, and she's like the hanging judge for J6ers. She's given them the greatest sentence in each of the cases she's had. So what do you think, where do you think that's going to go? And then in Atlanta, you've got Fannie Willis, the black DA, and the black sheriff there. He's getting indicted in these jurisdictions. And there's no hope, but they've seen what they can get away with. And so, yes, that's actually right there in Fulton County, Georgia. The grand jury just a couple of days ago, they've come back and say, hey, well, now that we've got Trump and Giuliani and Mark Meadows, his former chief of staff, and what, these 15 other co-defendants, let's go back and get Lindsey Graham now. So, I mean, how many senators are you going to have to arrest and indict? You remove two or three Republican senators, and this game's over. And it just goes to show, is this how you defend democracy, from depriving the people of being able to vote for the candidates that they want to vote for? This is how you defend democracy? But now they're going back now after sitting senators and former senators. And they're just going to, I guess they're going to, you know, what's to stop them from arresting and indicting everybody who voted for Trump and said, you supported this insurrection, so-called insurrection.
Didn't Orrin Schreuer, he's the guy at InfoWars?
Yeah.
I think he's going to, is he convicted and serving 60 days for saying things on a show regarding January 6th or regarding the election? And they're saying his words inspired the so-called insurrection. Now, of course, the fact that they say insurrection, of course, it does not meet the legal or even the literal definition of insurrection. They their opinion or their view is you just say it just because someone on MSNBC or CNN says it was an insurrection, or some politician says it is an insurrection. It's an insurrection. Well, obviously, it was not an insurrection. It was a protest that got riotous in some areas, and maybe to the extent that got riotous, might have been at the urging of feds installed to do that very thing if there's an actual investigation of that day. But now they've woven and created this narrative, which is completely false, and then they inject it into the courtroom. Not just this isn't just political rhetoric. You have judges now using this fantasy, this fantasy narrative to send people away for 18, 20 years to put people behind bars. Or in Schreuer, he's just a InfoWars guy or journalist, if you will, speaking on the things of the day, conspiracy theorist, maybe. I don't know what you want to call him, but that's his opinion. They've actually put this guy in jail for 60 days for this. And that's just outrageous.
Well, that's the first I've heard about that, but nothing surprises me anymore. There is no rule of law anymore. And this is the thing. This is the thing that's been so important about Trump, is that he has sort of opened the curtain. He's taken off the mask of what the system really is and how criminally corrupt it is. And they have
he made it go crazy.
Well, they've so overplayed their hand that they have shown themselves for what they truly are. Before Trump, again, you had these, whoever would win, we would lose. You had center right versus center left, none of them disagreeing on any issues of importance, whether it's George Bush or John Kerry or Mitt Romney or John McCain or Barack Obama. They essentially agreed on everything. And so you didn't have a choice there. The system was happy to let us go along acting like we were stakeholders in the system because we got to vote and it's a fair election. And hey, sometimes the Republican wins, sometimes the Democrat wins. But now we understand. And I think that it is important. What Trump has done is so important, even if it was done inadvertently. And I think that it was. But he exposed the system for what it truly is. Our people have no future on this continent. Under the present system, the government is criminally corrupt. And I'm not just saying that because I disagree with them. The courts are criminally corrupt. The media is criminally corrupt. And you have no future in this system. And I don't want to make America great again, Tim. This is something that I say now. I want to leave America behind and learn from the mistakes. If we're going to have a future, if we are going to have a salvation, it's going to have to come through a different means, whether it be secession or balkanization. Interestingly, you had Marjorie Taylor Greene on 9/11, no less. And I think that was a key day for her to say it again, call for the secession of the red states from the Union. And I think that, look, what's going on right now, that is not a wild proposition anymore. It really isn't. You've got sitting representatives now calling for secession. You have nascent secession movements cropping up in places like Idaho and Oregon and New Hampshire and in Texas. And that, when I say cropping up, I'm not talking about you got a couple of cranks on the internet advocating for secession in these states. I'm talking about county governments in the situation in Oregon, those counties wanting to peel off and be annexed by Idaho. In Texas, you've got a sitting representative who is submitting a piece of legislation calling for secession that's going to be presented next year. In New Hampshire, you actually already did have a vote on secession, and nobody knows this stuff. Now, obviously, it lost, or you really would have heard about it, but 13 members of the New Hampshire State House of Representatives voted to secede. It got voted down, and they kind of brushed it under the rug, but the guy who presented the bill in New Hampshire said, "This is the future for America, and we want to get out in front of it." And I think he's right. And here's why he's right. Is, again, the Trump indictments, he is going to go to prison. All right. There is no way he's not going to prison. There is. And he even admitted why. You look, he didn't even contest that, you know, baseless sexual assault thing with E. Jean Carroll. I can't get a fair trial in New York. I mean, he's not going to get a fair trial in Washington, D.C.
Didn't New York change the law for 1 year, repealing the statute of limitations?
Right. Say again?
Sexual battery case that he lost?
Yeah. Well, this is it. I mean, there is no law. That's the thing.
Yeah.
And if you can't count, and this is what the Trump voters are really beginning to realize, and this is why they're beginning to get a little more radical in their outlook. And I don't mean radical as in violent. I mean radical as in thinking about alternative solutions like secession, not going out and doing what the left does and killing people and burning things. But if you have no hope for recourse in free and fair elections or through the rule of law in the courts, then what have you got? If the courts are rigged against you and elections are rigged against you, are you going to continue to be a part of that system? I think people are beginning to understand that there is no future under this system. And you've got the Trump indictments, as we mentioned, all of this stuff. You've got now, again, as we mentioned, the Fulton County grand jury now recommending charges against sitting senators like Lindsey Graham. You've got, how about this? If somehow, some way, I mean, Trump is going to prison, but if somehow, some way he's able to run and win the election from behind bars, they've got a failsafe. They've already got a backup. You've already got an effort underway in Colorado and some of these other swing states to remove Trump from the ballot. So even if he is allowed to run, we'll just remove him from the state ballot using some crook interpretation of the 14th Amendment. You've got the governor of New Mexico. The Democratic governor of New Mexico announced a few days ago that she has the authority to suspend the First and Second Amendment. She did. She said for the next 30 days, the Second Amendment is repealed in New Mexico because we got to fight gun violence. So, I mean, listen, that happened. That happened. Yeah. And I don't know how many people know about this. You got, you know, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene calling for secession. But all of this stuff, I mean, that is not a society that is in good health. This is a society that it's in its death throes. And now the Republicans, maybe it's political theater. I mean, it is political theater, but so were the impeachments of Donald Trump. Now you got the Republicans filing an inquiry to impeach Joe Biden. So this whole system is on a collision course, the red versus the blue. And you've got the blue state arresting the president of red state America, forbidding him from, trying to forbid him from running. All of the stuff we just mentioned, I know everybody said it forever, right? This next election is the most important of my lifetime. It's like, this fight is the fight of the century until the next fight of the century, a year later. But this really is something different, Tim. This is something that is not just unprecedented in so much as nobody living in America has ever seen anything like this before here. It is so unprecedented that it has never happened in the entire history of the Republic, going back to Jamestown and Plymouth Rock and all of that. Never have you seen anything like you're seeing now. And it continues to evolve and spiral by the day.
And yet, and of course, to make matters worse, or in fact, more clear, perhaps, is obviously we have a president who's non corpus mentis, right? And he literally is a figurehead, if not even that, because he doesn't much, he's mentally gone. We've always kind of understood that presidents aren't their own men. They're installed and are elected, and they don't have much power, really, because they have to deal with the bureaucracy, the CIA, and all the interests, the donors, and the powers that be. But this, in the case with Joe Biden, it's obvious this person is just sinking deeper and deeper into dementia. He can't even. Did you see that press conference in Vietnam? Where?
Oh my God! I mean, he's been that bad since he announced that he was running. I mean, when he did all the campaigning from the basement, and yeah, like you said, I mean, Biden is only the president. It's not like even if he were in good health, he would actually be the one in control. But I mean, just the fact that they try to prop him up and make people believe that he's calling the shots. I mean, it's entirely unbelievable. And then the whole thing with the senator up in Pennsylvania, Fetterman.
Yeah,
he makes Biden look like the exemplar of mental and
physical. Yeah, our gerontocracy. There's a Dianne Feinstein. I think maybe dead. I think she actually may be dead. And then you have the Republican majority leader Mitch McConnell, right?
Yeah, yeah. What's going on with that? That's almost frightening. I mean, I don't like any of these people, but that you've mentioned. But at the same time, I mean, it's scary. I don't ever remember anything being like that, even a few years ago, where you have these people that are obviously just out to lunch and barely alive. And the ones you're mentioning are like the top end. It's the top Republican and the president.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the guy that's playing the role of president.
And yeah, and we have a system which somehow you can get someone like Kamala Harris being president.
Well,
what type of system?
Well, yeah, because and she was the most unliked Democrat of the Democratic primaries of 2020. She had 0% support.
This is our democracy?
Yeah. No, it's just a joke. But I'm just telling you, the whole thing, we don't have honest elections. You don't have any recourse unless you are some woke freak. You have no voice in the system. You're not going to get a resolution through the electoral process or in the courts. And I'll just give you, in the grand scheme of things, a very trivial example that I had personal experience with, but it just goes to show just another example of how corrupt these courts are. Again, 20 years for milling around the Capitol. And if you burn down cities, though, not only do you not go to jail, you get paid. They're paying out. These Democratic controlled areas are writing checks to these people. And through the courts, I might add. But I actually filed a lawsuit, a defamation lawsuit, a libel lawsuit against the Detroit News, which is the major daily paper of Detroit, Michigan. We're all called white supremacists. I mean, Trump, me, you, everybody that has even the slightest disagreement with the left is called all of these things, and we always have been. But that is constitutionally protected free speech. So you get to you say, well, what actually does rise to the level of libel? Because you've got libel laws and you've got defamation laws. So what, you know, well, here's a textbook example from the Restatement of Torts is to allege that a person is a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And the Detroit News wrote in an opinion article right after I interviewed Donald Trump Jr. that I was not only a member of the Klan, but the leader of the Klan. They printed that I was the leader of the Ku Klux Klan. And I contacted a lawyer in Michigan, a brilliant lawyer. He was a fantastic attorney. And he took on my case. And he said, this is actually the textbook. And he explained to me what the Restatement of Torts is. And this is actually the textbook definition of libel. It's just an open and shut, black and white. This is the law. And they may not like you, but this is the law. And so we filed this lawsuit and we just got ran out of the trial court. I mean, they dismissed it, you know. And so we appealed to the Michigan Court of Appeals, and the case and the law and the case precedent was just airtight. And the Court of Appeals, I remember getting the call. I'll actually look it up so I can read directly from the ruling, and I'll make this quick and we'll move on. But I think this is just an interesting thing to sort of just crystallize this for the listeners. I remember getting the call that the decision had come in. It was a panel of judges. It wasn't a jury trial. It was a panel of three judges. And the decision had come in. And I remember reading the opening paragraph of the decision. And I thought that we had won, and this would be a great victory. And it proves that, okay, maybe the system can work for dissidents. This was back in 2016, and it took to 2017 to resolve. The newspaper article in question was in March of 2016. And it was on Halloween Day of 2017 when the Court of Appeals issued its decision. And it begins by reading, and I'm reading from the official decision now. You can look it up for yourself, James Edwards versus Detroit News decision. The Restatement of Torts lists membership in the Ku Klux Klan as the quintessential illustration of a defamatory statement. In an opinion piece in the Detroit News, columnist Bancole Thompson asserted that radio talk show host James Edwards is a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. There is no record evidence to suggest that Edwards holds a formal leadership position in the Ku Klux Klan, nor is there any record evidence to suggest that he is even a member. So I read that and I was thinking, we won this case, the justice has been served. And then I read the next one, the next sentence. However, mindful of Aesop's lesson, talking about Aesop's fables, a man is known by the company he keeps. We hold that Edwards cannot make claims of defamation and affirm summary disposition in favor of the defendants. This was a published opinion that rewrote libel law in the state of Michigan. That's how far removed from actual law this ruling was. It rewrote the libel law in the state of Michigan. This now sets the precedent. Yes, the law is you can't say that, but Aesop's fables says judge a man by the company he keeps. And that's how they made that ruling. They're, the only thing that matters in court now is what side you're on. Laws make no difference. And we're seeing that all over the place now. And that was my little lesson. I got my medicine on that one. And then what Benjamin Franklin said, experience keeps a dear school, but a fool will learn in no other way. And so I learned. And what they're talking about, what are they talking about? The company that I keep. The one that they cited was an Atlanta attorney, dear friend of mine, Sam Dixon.
Oh, yeah. I had him on one of my I've interviewed him.
He is just a great man. And
didn't he just defend some Klan members or something?
That's it. That is the association.
Well, mindful of Aesop's lesson. That's what a lawyer is supposed to do.
Well, here, get this. That was in the 1970s, by the way. So he's been a lawyer for 50 years. And at one point in his 50-year career, he took on a client who was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. And that is how this court tap danced away from what the textbook definition of libel is, to use this mental gymnastics to say, well, we have to remember Aesop's fables, man is known by the company he keeps. And because I know Sam Dixon, who 50 years ago defended a man in the Klan, that means that I guess I'm the leader of the Ku Klux Klan. But the man that Dixon defended, this is interesting, was Daniel Carver, who went to become a member of Howard Stern's WAC.
Yes.
So, I mean, is Howard Stern now the leader of the Ku Klux Klan? Because he actually associates with Daniel Carver. I only associated with the lawyer that defended him 50 years ago. So this is where we're at. So, yeah, I mean, if you that's sort of like a trivial, almost comical miscarriage of justice. Well,
these people are Bolsheviks. Who's doing what to whom? Right, that's their standard. That's their point of view. It's the, you know, friends enemy distinction, and that's the problem. We talk about the breakdown in trust and confidence of the system among, you know, normies, Americans, because they've been told that we have elections, we have courts of law, then there's political differences, but we have these protections to keep things honest and relatively civilized. Well, obviously, it isn't the case anymore because the criminal justice system, the civil law system with lawfare. You're weaponizing courts of law. Yeah.
And they really started that with Charlottesville. It's when they really started getting into lawfare. You know,
it's a complete abuse of the courts, and the fact that any lawyer was, what's her name, Roberta Kaplan, who's, you know, well funded by various foundations, mostly Jewish, to go after these people, to harass these people.
But see, they know, Tim, that all they got to do, you know, they'll do a little judge shopping, and they'll get it into a venue that they know will be favorable to them, and they cannot lose. Because, I mean, again, my case was trivial in terms of I was the plaintiff in that case, and I lost. But other than the injustice of it all, I didn't, you know, I wasn't sent to prison for 20 years. But they know that they can't lose in the courts now, because my case is one example. But we see now that the only thing that matters is not rule of law, but what side you're on. And all you got to do is get it into a court, and the judges know where their bread is buttered, and they're going to give the system the ruling that they want. I mean, the judges probably are already completely on board with that agenda to begin with. But even if they had a little bit of, you know, second thought, they still, you know, they don't want to be bothered. They don't want the ADL coming after them. They don't want to end up like these people. So they know which way they're expected to roll.
But people see this, though. People see this.
Well, that they are seeing it. And that's, again, this is why I believe we're heading for something. And they've gotten away with so much. I mean, this lawfare now where they are aggressively just bringing up these phony charges, because they know once they get the case into a court, they're going to get a favorable ruling. Nothing is going to stop them. They believe that to such an extent now that they're going after the president and sitting senators, and they're right. They are right. Oh, it was an all-white dude.
Okay, we're back. A little technical difficulty. Sorry about that. Let's go. Okay.
Yeah, so the lawfare, this is another way that they are dispossessing the majority. And again, it's got all the way up to now where they feel that they can go after the president, former president, and sitting senators. And they can get away with it in these districts where they predominate, like Atlanta, like Washington, like New York. And this is another thing. I mean, orthodoxy has become violent on their deathbed. And the repression has not worked. The censorship, the deplatforming, all of the things that they have done to people who have a different opinion has not worked. Individuals have been punished, they've been fired, organizations have been bankrupted, but social discontent, however, has only intensified. The radicalization has gone vertical, again, as my friend Brad Griffin puts it, and we're light years away from where we were in 2016.
Well, this is radicalization, not so much extreme, but radicalization that you're getting to the root of the problem. People
to be clear about that. I said that a moment ago. I'm not talking about our people are radicalizing in the way that the left radicalizes, where they go out and they're going to harm people and kill people and damage property and do all the things that the left does, which is what they call peaceful protesting. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm talking about radicalization in terms of mindset and in terms of understanding. And I think that this is a radical thing to say that we have no hope under the current system. The current system will not allow us a place at the table. There is no hope through the courts or through the electoral process. And we're going to have to look for a different solution, like secession, for instance. And that's what I talk about radical. That is being radical in the best sense of the word. You're actually seeing things clearly now. That's the radicalization I'm talking about. And so here we are now in 2023, where it became clear with the Trump indictments that we're on our way to a major constitutional crisis. The things that we mentioned a few minutes ago, the things that have happened since this summer started, that's just stuff that's happened in the last couple of months, Tim. I think any one of those things that we've been talking about would have been the single biggest news story of a year. And you have all of this stuff, a sitting governor suspending the Second Amendment, these Trump arrests, the arrest, you know, the charges now that they want to bring against Lindsey Graham, all of this stuff. It's just, that's just happening one on top of another, one after another. The system is it's in trouble, I think, in a way. The partisan hatred has reached historic levels. I think, again, at no point, war between the states, Jim Crow, slavery, wherever, never have people been so far apart. The political class is making extraordinary, reckless gambles, both here and abroad. And the mainstream political atmosphere has become fevered. We're in a real phase of destabilization. Norms are dissolving, taboos are disappearing, and the stability of the current regime seems to be liquefying.
Well, it's become deranged in many ways. I mean, it isn't just a press. You have like examples like in California where they're passing laws requiring parents to affirm gender.
Yeah.
You know, yes. Identity.
That's a whole other thing. But yeah, that's a big part of what's going on now. Forcing kids through critical race theory to believe that they're guilty and evil for having been born white. This transgenderism sickness, forcing parents to go along with that. In some of these states, it's like, I think they're passing laws where a counselor who's helping a kid, quote unquote, transition, that it's like against the law for them to tell their parents. It's just really sick.
But that was in Michigan. Yeah, they banned what they call conversion therapy, but this, that Orwellian twisting of the language, whereas if you're telling someone to behave in accordance with their biology and reality, you're not converting them. In any ways, you're setting them straight back on to the natural path.
It's child genital mutilation, and these people are going to be sterilized for life. And what you always see, you mean the media glamorizes it because they're satanic. This is a satanic thing we're talking about. What they never show you is, I would really like to know, if we had an honest media, if we had honest journalists, I would love for there to be some research on how many people who mutilate themselves and forever sterilize themselves and cut off their sex organs, how many of them actually come to regret it pretty quickly. I'd really like to know the number on that. You never hear those stories.
Well, I think 83% of those who express gender dysphoria correct. They go start to behave like their biological sex.
Because you can mutilate yourself, but you're not changing your chromosomes. You're not changing any of that. You know, used to they called these people transvestites or cross-dressers.
Yeah.
You know, they, which is what they still are. You can pretend to be.
Well, these are in many ways wounded, victimized, harmed people themselves of the system that they've created. The evil genius of the system is it'll create these the soldiers for further transgression or revolution by creating sort of hordes of damaged people, and that's what the society creates with the media and the education system being infiltrated by these people. The system's been infiltrated. It's one thing is you can pass all the laws you want, but at the end of the day, you're gonna have to have a purge of these people.
Well, this is just another thing of it that has separated the people. I mean, this issue, which is entirely media manufactured, and people are really, 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 really becoming a lot more like us in their mindset. And that's a good thing, because I mean, what the ADL and SPLC calls us notwithstanding, I think what we see is I think we see things very clearly and certainly very healthily, but there's still going to have to be an event. As long as people are still relatively content and comfortable, I mean, and it just makes sense, right? I mean, as long as a man is comfortable, I understand this isn't a bad thing in and of itself. As a man, as a father, as a husband, you have to provide for your family. Mm-hmm. And it's a hard thing to ask men to go out there and do things that are going to risk causing them the sort of economic distress that makes it where they can't provide for their family. And so as long as you're getting by like that, you might not like what you see. But a man who is content is not really going to take the risks that are going to be needed eventually. But when the bottom falls out, when people aren't able to feed their kids or keep their kids warm, then you're going to have a real sort of boomerang type of effect, a real recoil type of effect. And I don't know. I don't think the Trump arrest and whatever they do to Trump next year is going to be the event that pops it off. I think it's going to further polarize and destabilize things for sure. Absolutely. I think people are going to continue to arrive at the conclusion that there is no hope under this system. We're going to have something different. And I think more people are arriving there every day. And I don't mean by the handful, I mean by the droves. And what they are doing to Trump is certainly going to further harden, you know, the opinions like that. But it's going to be an economic collapse or maybe even a world war. Once the bottom falls out like that, then you're going to have a chance for some real lasting and significant change. But it's going to have to take some discomfort. It's going to have to take some suffering before we get there, and that's okay.
Well, it's necessary because that's when, I mean, it's an uncomfortable time because we don't know how these things turn out. And obviously a quickening or an acceleration of collapse doesn't necessarily bring immediately a beneficial political development. It's funny because if you look at it, what happens, it's almost like these people create the conditions for an eventual strongman. Then but they never blame themselves.
Well, you are exactly right. And I actually said that in my closing remarks at AMRIN. Mm-hmm. I said that all of this that's happening and all of what's going to come doesn't guarantee our victory, but it at least gives us an opportunity. And we've been deprived of that opportunity since the post-World War II era. But you're right. Now, listen, interestingly, I don't favor democracy. Our people have existed and thrived and prospered under all kinds of different forms of government going back throughout the histories of Europe and the different European nations. We don't have to have whatever this is. If this is democracy, if this is defending democracy to, you know, arrest presidents and throw him off the ballots and have a rigged court and a rigged media and a rigged government, if that's democracy, I don't want anything of it. I think we will need some sort of an authoritarian strongman, and I would welcome him. Because I know this, we have no future. I've said this before tonight. We have no future under the current system, under the current trajectory. We have no future on this continent. We lose. And we don't only lose, we are subjugated.
Well, when you're dealing with a political opposition or an adversary who no longer plays by the rules, what do you do? I mean, they've hijacked democracy, then imposed tyranny. So how do? So obviously any political route is going to be perilous and risky. Everything in life has a risk. But if you look at in the past, like during the Spanish Civil War with Franco, he had to step in and get rid of the communists who had taken over, taken advantage of political turmoil in Spain for the past, 30 years, particularly in the 30s. And same thing, in various countries like Chile, 1973, there's a lot else going on, Cold War and CIA. But again, you had another a plurality socialist government elected, then choosing a radical route. And then what do? You need someone to step in and put an end to it. And they create the very conditions. A good example is Weimar Germany, right? They just go too far. And then, there's an authoritarian reaction.
Absolutely, and we'll need it here. And I'm a big fan of Franco. And I, again, some of these fascist regimes, so-called fascist regimes, look pretty good to me compared to what this is.
Yeah,
there's no justice. There's no fairness in this. And
there's no reciprocity. If you don't have any reciprocity, why should I play by the rules?
Well, exactly. And I mean, Weimar Germany. I mean, a lot of the stuff that was going on there that gave that rise that you mentioned is the exact same things that are going on here. And I don't think a lot of people know that. Obviously the economy was in shambles. You had the rape at Versailles. There was a lot of other economic factors that were going on. But a lot of the social stuff was very similar in terms of they were pushing transgenderism in Weimar Germany. Mm-hmm. A lot of those books, we hear about which is just totally ironic because the system now are the modern day book burners. They won't let our books, be put on Amazon and things like that.
Yes.
Those books they were burning, though, were, some perverted things like we're talking about here.
Well, Burke Burns, I'm sorry, can David Irving sell his books in Germany?
I doubt it. Surely not.
Talk to Germar Rudolph.
I don't think he'd sell them anywhere in Europe.
Yeah, so I mean, then the Bundesrepublik, the post-war, has burned, a thousand times more books than the Nazis ever did. When the Nazis did it, it was a political demonstration. They didn't go scour libraries. It was a protest.
And I have a problem with that. Listen, a lot of these books need to be burned. This stuff that is damaging and harmful and anti-Christ and anti-family.
Oh, Magnus Hirschfeld? Yeah, burn his stuff.
You got to burn that stuff. You got to get
Yeah, they smuggled out and ended up at the Kinsey Institute. Great. That's great stuff you got there. That's great research.
Yeah.
And it's not science. It's all degenerate. You know, it's all pseudoscience.
Same stuff. And we can only hope that there will be some sort of reaction above and beyond the Mitt Romney type of conservatism, the true conservatism, as they put it.
Yeah.
All of the Republicans are populist demagogues now. We need somebody that's going to come and restore order. We absolutely need that, because you're not going to be able to do it through the existing system. So what are you going to do? You just want to die? Do you want to be displaced and dispossessed? I don't want, and this is key, Tim. I don't want anybody to suffer, other people groups, other races. But my first priority, obviously, my first interest is that of my own family. I'm always going to put the interest of my family above that of others. And so, is it wrong for us to want our culture and our traditions and way of life to predominate in a homeland of our own? I don't think so.
Well, look what they're doing. Look what they're doing, like in Chicago or New York, where, you have these migrant crisis, you have crime, out of control crime. Is that compassionate? They'll focus on one shooting, but in a weekend in Chicago in the summer, you have 30 people shot, all on the South Side, and they're all black, And so it's one of is that compassionate?
Well, that's also why you're never going to have an all-black state or whatever they were advocating for. They abort themselves and murder each other too often to raise their proportion of the population.
Well, you can have an all-black state, but who's going to keep the water running and the power grid on?
Well, you've seen it, right? I mean, in Jackson, Mississippi, yes. And other places. I mean, they can't. You can give them first-world civilization and just hand it to them on a platter, completely abandon the towns, but they can't maintain it. And listen, that's not a knock. That's just the truth. I'm not mocking them or making fun of them or wishing them ill will, but I got to say, I don't want to live like that. And I don't want my kids to have
I'm sorry. If you go to the African American Museum a couple of years ago in D.C., the Smithsonian Institute, they had a plaque there that had listed attributes of white supremacy or whiteness. And that was what punctuality, exactitude. I said, these things that keep these are the things that keep that built the aqueducts that give you plumbing and the power grid and make sure the bridges don't collapse and the planes don't crash. Well, if you don't have that, you can't have a modern civilization. So you can't not call it white supremacy, call it white culture, whatever you want. Nevertheless, it enables the establishment maintenance of modern society. Now we have a competency crisis in the country because of this a fetish towards diversity. Is societal collapse a cost we must pay for diversity? Well, yes, it is, because the modern society we see is a uniquely European, Occidental, Western creation, which people mimic. Some societies do very well copying it, like East Asian societies.
Correct. You're absolutely right.
Some societies, like Africa, can't do it, evidently. They just simply haven't been able to do it. That doesn't mean they can't ever do it, but it's just a current, it's a reality. And if they're going to ever do it, they're going to have to mimic and have a respect and almost like a stand in amazement of white European civilization. But in the past 60 years, the narrative is white people evil. And it's so they lambast or they disregard or they slander everything Western and European and white. Well, then your civilization collapses. Sherman wrote an article a few years ago, maybe several years ago, talking about how the world stands in awe and also in resentment of European man for his achievements.
Now, you know what? You're onto something here, my friend. That really is why there is so much hatred against whites. Why do they hate us so? It's because of jealousy. And if you're going to have that, it's just better to wish everyone the very best of success for their people and their culture and everything they want to propagate, put out there. But it's got to be done apart. It's got to be done. We need our own homelands. And
even missionaries went over there. They didn't bring them back. Right. And there's a, like I'm talking about the Jesuits who missions in Canada, who died for their faith, preaching the faith. People went in South America. They went there and their idea was development. They had to have these crazy notions of mixing everyone together. It actually was the Freemasons that destroyed the Jesuit, the missionary work, because and they developed the slave model, which we're all paying for now, because it's slaves that created, you know, injected these people into the country and created this long term problem, which we can never resolve because of the narrative. It's kind of, you know, it's
terrible mistake. You know, the slavery thing,
but people were saying reparations for slavers. Oh yeah, I'm all for it, because I think we all need compensation. I'm going to put up with this problem for so many years. All the white people.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they need to pay us the reparations. But that's the thing too about this whole racism gambit. And I wrote about this in that book you mentioned in 2010, Racism Schmacism. Everything whites do is racist. The blacks claim their failures on slavery. Well, how many of them have suffered under it? Not any.
Was it Joy Reid? You know, that woman who was at MSNBC?
Yeah.
She talks about racism and slavery. Her parents came to the country in the 1960s.
Well, exactly.
They chose to come to this racist country.
Well, they've got an ATM that never runs out of $100 bills, so they're just going to keep going back to it and putting in the white guilt.
Well, that's a scam too. Even if you had a reparations thing and you had this, you paid them all $1 million, within 6 months they'd all be bankrupt, because it'd be like lottery winners, and it would be big corporations who got rich from it because of the orgy of consumer spending that the reparation payments would create.
Well, it's just like professional athletes, they make tens of millions of dollars, they're broke a year after they're out of the league. But everything whites do is racist, and if it isn't slavery, it's something else. They say white flight is racist behavior. So if you live in an area where blacks are beginning to predominate and you move, you're a racist. But guess what? Another thing that is also racist, so they tell us, is gentrification. If you're white and you move into a predominantly black area, you're trying to change the makeup of the community. So if you leave, you're a racist. If you move in, you're a racist. Doesn't seem like we can win that game. And so, again, we'd be better off apart. But and I think that's certainly the direction we're heading. Yeah, one way or another, this country's going to balkanize. I don't know if it's going to be a racial line, there's going to be red blue to begin with, or what. But mainstream politics has become so sick and fevered. The liberal establishment making these moves, just a spiral of destabilization. I think the political order, this post World War II order, is rapidly collapsing. And the fact that there are even people so delusional as to say the things and do the things that we've been covering tonight shows that there is some sort of a deep crisis, and you can only take so much political stress before it has to vent. I mean, you can only take so much before there has to be an event that alleviates it, and one side wipes the other side off of the board, rhetorically speaking, or perhaps politically speaking, or even worse. I mean, we see this in the rise and falls of empires and governments. And I'm not saying that that's going to be a good thing when we devolve into open conflict, but I do think that that's probable. I think that the way that we're on right now, what we're seeing this summer, makes all of that very likely.
It's a path they've chosen.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a path.
They have thrust it upon us. Absolutely.
It's not something. Yeah, it's not pleasant. Just a reality. And if they wanted to back off and actually make concessions, things would simmer down, but they're not willing to do that.
They don't do it. I mean, they don't do it. They don't. There's. It's all about what they can take and what they can get, and they never give anything back. You never have a victory where something goes back to the way it was, which is when it was better. And have you ever even heard them? We've heard the grievances, have we not? Have you ever heard any gratitude? I mean, they are so dishonest. They can't say one nice thing about this country that has given them the best standard of high standard of living of anywhere in the world. And I'm not talking about just other racial groups, but the left itself. There's not one thing they can say about America or traditional America or heritage Americans, as Peter Brimelow calls them at VDare. There's not one kind thing they can say. It's all evil, evil, evil. That's what, by the way, that's what critical race theory is. The theory is to criticize, and they do it incessantly.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's just constant criticism on white history, white culture, and never even, we don't like this, but you got to say, this is good. And there's just no honest debate about it.
Well, the very language that they use to critique and criticize, you know, European or white civilization are the ideas of the West. They wouldn't even have that language if it weren't for Western ideas that they're using. You know, they give, they're super critical, but they don't apply that same criticism to so-called indigenous or non-white societies, which wouldn't fare too well under the very standards that they're condemning Western societies.
Well, I mean, it's just, again, they're so dishonest, the double standard. I mean, who needs to be told that the left engages in double standards and hypocrisy now? But the whole thing, yeah. Every racial group can be proud of their history and heroes and culture and traditions and history, but except for the one group that can't do it.
Yeah, I think tomorrow is American Hispanic Heritage starts or something, right?
That's something every something every day now like that.
And I think California, August is Transgendered Heritage Month or
they've
something.
They've got the Black History Month. Now they've got the ridiculous Juneteenth, and June is Homosexual Month. And
yeah.
I mean, you know.
So, yep. So there you go. Well, James, I said I had it for an hour and a half. So I think
I have thoroughly enjoyed it. I wasn't even watching the clock. It sure didn't feel like an hour and a half. But I would just say, I guess if we're about to close, to everybody listening, keep the faith, because things change throughout history. I've said this in my recent speaking tour this summer. You know, for 500 years, the Spanish were under Muslim occupation until they weren't. And then that gave birth to the Christopher Columbus and the Age of Exploration, and our people conquered the world. So things can change. They changed in Russia. I mean, look at Russia now. There's a new sheriff in town over there. Mm-hmm. Totally different than what it was when those people were being starved out and murdered by the Jewish Bolsheviks and communists. And then again, you know, the Aztec Empire, just another example. These are disparate examples, but Aztec Empire was at the, you know, the height of its power about 5 minutes before Cortez showed up with a handful of conquistadors. So history can change, and I think it will change here, and I think it can change for the better here. But whatever happens, I know we were all born, anybody listening now, no matter how old they are, were born during the nadir of the American experiment, the real low point from the 1950s onward. The 1950s were obviously seemed like heaven compared to now, but the rot had already, you know, been implanted, and it took you know, several decades for the fruit of that corrupt seed to truly blossom. But we see things through the very limited vision of our own lifetimes, and our short time on Earth really doesn't really amount to a lot of things, unless you consider yourself to be part of a continuum that links us to our ancestors and to our future descendants. And then what you do really matters. But just our little short time looking after number one, that's just not important. And so if you lose who you are, and you lose your identity, and you lose the things that make you get separated from all of that, you're really dead already. So I know that things can get hard, but great men aren't made except through great trials. And we'll have to take what comes as an opportunity to forge our character and to become smarter and to prove our worth. And we'll have that opportunity. And I know not everybody can be up front, but folks, you can support the people who are up front, people like Tim Kelly. And I want to thank you again, Tim, for having me on tonight. Let me talk about these things, because we really are at a crossroads, and not at the crossroads like of the Bush and Kerry election. You know, no matter who wins, we lose. You know, yeah, there's real things are happening.
Two bonesmen running for president.
we're coming up on something here. We're actually in the midst of it. I mean, the collapse has already started. The collapse started in, you could argue, 2016, but certainly by 2020. And it has continued at a breakneck pace since. So it's coming. Don't betray a brother. Keep the faith. Don't capitulate on our issues. Support the people who are doing good work. And we'll see you out there. But be a man, and remember to make your ancestors proud.
Well, thank you so much. I'll let you go. Thank you for spending some time with me this evening. Get back to your family. I'll post it soon, and I'll post all the links, and we'll go from there. Thanks.
Hey, thanks, brother. Love to have you on ours too, and I'll stay in touch. And again,
sure, certainly.
Thanks for giving me the time.
So much, and good night then. Take care.
Thanks, buddy. Bye-bye.
let us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag. So we bought pack cigarettes and Mrs. Wagner pies and walked off to look for America. Kathy, I said as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh, Michigan seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America. Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. I said, be careful, his bow tie's really a camera. Toss me a cigarette, I think there's one in my raincoat. We smoked the last one an hour ago. So I looked at the scenery. She read her magazine, and the moon rose over an open field. Kathy, I'm lost, I said. Though I knew she was sleeping, I'm empty and aching, and I don't know why. Counting the cars on the New Jersey turnpike, they've all come to look for.